It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Unsolved murders can become cold cases and then fall off the radar screens of local detectives. And that's where the Murder Accountability Project comes in. The group sifts through large amounts of homicide data to find crime patterns and predict possible outcomes. Tom Hargrove started that project, and he joins me on the line from Virginia. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Celeste. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you as well. And with us as well is the project's co-director, Mike Arntfield. He's a criminology professor at Western University in Ontario, Canada, and his students are now studying murder data that was collected in the Atlanta metro area. Mike joins us by Skype. Hi, Mike.
Morning, Celeste. How are you?
It's good to have you as well. So Tom, we really want to talk about the solve rate, but in order to talk about that, we need to talk first about your algorithm. Tell us how you developed this algorithm, which is a new one in law enforcement.
Yeah, we were aware for many years of the challenge that police face in identifying serial killings. Linkage blindness, pattern blindness has been called a few things, but it's very hard for case-based investigators to link cases that have similar attributes because a homicide detective is assigned to a case and another homicide detective is assigned to another case. If they share information, there's a chance the linkage will be made, but if not, they don't. So we developed an algorithm to try to overcome that problem, which takes FBI computer files and turns, we have records now on more than 700,000 murders in the United States, and the algorithm turns that into about 10,000 groups. We group according to the geography of the killing, the gender of the victim, the age group of the victim, and the weapon used to kill the victim. Those four variables are grouping variables. And then we tell the computer to look at those 10,000 groups and identify those groups that had an extremely low rate of solution. Experience tells us that often a very, very low rate of solution occurs because there are common killers who so far have not been apprehended. Atlanta's strangulation victims are sending a red alert to our algorithm and have for many years. The Atlanta strangulations, especially the female strangulations, are one of the largest clusters of suspicious murders in the nation.
So this may be the first time that people here are hearing about the Atlanta strangulation murders. Mike, can you give us more information about that?
So what we're looking at is, as Tom mentioned, these large clusters of, if you go to our site at murderdata.org, you'll see that we identify unsolved murders in red. So there's a visual representation of the data there that will really sort of, again, if people haven't seen this before or heard about this, really sort of jar them, I think, when they see it. And what we're looking at in particular, my cold case initiative at the university, is from 1985 to 2000. I mean, there is a much larger set of victims than that, but in sort of delineating the victim pool to between 85 and 2000, we've got 72 females who have been strangled and where those cases are also unsolved. So as Tom mentioned, large clusters of unsolved, but then in addition to that, strangulation as a cause of death, those are two very good discriminators to suggest that we're dealing with a serial offender targeting strangers or stranger on stranger attacks, which are statistically rare, which is when you see large spikes like this in a metropolitan statistical area, is again cause for major concern.
So, Tom, one of the things that your data has sort of called to my mind is this dip in the solve rates. So in the 1960s, the solve rate on murders, homicides, was almost 90%. And I'm looking at the statistics right now. As of 2015, it's just above 60%. And yet we have so much more technology at our disposal at this point. And, you know, enough people have watched all those CSI TV shows to believe that, you know, you can solve a murder based on a flake of skin at a murder site. So why do you think the solve rate has gone down so far?
Yeah, unfortunately, if you get your opinions about homicide investigations from television, you think all murders are solved in 60 minutes by beautiful people in squad rooms surrounded by gorgeous color monitors.
Right.
It just isn't that way. increasingly, police departments are squeezed financially. We have insufficient resources applied to the problem of murder. There are just not enough trained homicide detectives going after the bad guys. That's probably the primary problem. Also, we like to say that it's a failure of will by local political leaders to make major crimes a priority. Mayors and city councils face increasing competition for every limited dollar they have, and so they have made a decision that often means there aren't enough homicide detectives working the cases, and that's exactly what's gone on over time.
So we spoke with Adam Lee III. He's the major crimes commander with the Atlanta Police Department, works with the homicide unit. He says the APD actually forwarded two of its cases to the Murder Accountability Project recently. Here's what he says.
We feel that for some reason, with quite a few of our homicides, people know, but they just don't tell for whatever reason. I mean, you would think that offering large amounts of reward money would get people to talk, but that doesn't always work.
Mike, you were a detective in Canada for some time. How big a problem is it that people don't give the police the information they need to solve murders?
Well, that's a major contributing factor. And I mean, aside from, as Tom mentioned, the will to devote proper financial and human resources to this problem, we can also see in Canada really where I will say there is not necessarily in most cases as progressive a policy in terms of engaging the media and engaging the public. We see that agencies that routinely bury information are very circumspect in press briefings in terms of sharing information and don't solicit public input, have a much higher unsolved rate than those who, you know, whether it's a few weeks later or a few years later, come back to cases and begin to sort of parsimoniously release bits of evidence with a view to, again, sort of tweaking public interest and keeping cases alive. So between what's gone on in Atlanta and I would say the larger problem, and especially as we see in Canada, is that the public you cannot solve these cases without some degree of public input. And that's in large part why we exist and why the Murder Accountability Project does not keep secrets. We essentially crowdsource and make this data available to the public with the hopes that, you know, people will, of their own volition, see what's going on in their backyard or find a record on there that they know something about and then maybe come forward.
I'm speaking with Mike Arntfield of Western University. He teaches criminology there, and Tom Hargrove of the Murder Accountability Project. The project relies on homicide data nationwide to find trends in murders. And let's hear another comment from Adam Lee of the Atlanta Police Department. He's talking about being able to solve homicides because of new DNA technology.
Just about everything contains DNA these days. Anything you touch, now that we have the touch DNA technology, it's not just bodily fluids anymore. It's anything that any surface that suspect or a person may have touched near or in the crime scene helps us solve cases now.
And yet, Mike, there are limitations to DNA evidence. Obviously, if somebody is not in the database, you're not going to be able to get a match. So how does you have your students sifting through data? What data are they looking at?
What we're looking at, so this is going to be a multi-tiered operation. I mean, it's been years since these cases have been looked at substantively, so we're not going to solve this overnight. But the first thing we're doing is assigning victims to these names. So of those 72, and again, I should stress these are not all APD cases. These are metropolitan statistical area cases. So there are some neighboring sheriff's departments that own these records and are still investigating these cases. But from Atlanta PD, we have received a vetted list of now 33 names. Again, we've received more names than that, but we have limited the names to 33 of female victims of a certain demographic and age group that we feel may be able to be linked. And what we're doing now is we're going through and we're trying to figure out the life stories of these women through various software programs, through soliciting, media input and public input. And the idea is that we can assign some kind of biographical narrative and find out who these women were. What were they doing for a living? Where did they live? Did they have substance abuse issues? Did they have strong family connections? Did they have police records? The idea being that if we can begin to, and this is a process generally known as victimology, so studying crimes through sort of the life of the victims. And what we're hoping to do is to begin to identify then larger linkages between certain victim types. I mean, all we have through the FBI data is the ethnicity and the age and the gender. So we need more than that to be able to definitively link these victims. That starts with the names. And I will say that Atlanta Police records, the people working there have been remarkably helpful in finding what in many cases are names and investigations that have no digital record. They've gone and had to find the original actual hard copy analog murder book, as we call it, that's been stored away for, you know, 20 years now.
So in a way, Tom, your algorithm adds a completely different tool for law enforcement. And I say that because even Adam Lee of the APD says that, especially in recent years, sometimes the solution of a case comes down to chance. Here he is talking about cameras.
You know, people have cameras at their homes, businesses have cameras, you know, the cities, the streets have cameras. So there was a time there just last year where we had like three homicides in a row that were actually on video, the whole incident, because they were in the area where someone happened to have a camera.
So that's kind of the opposite of what your algorithm does, Tom. And yet it's been successful in the past at identifying places where possible serial killers may be operating. Why? How is your algorithm successful at that?
Because it identifies locations that have had an astonishingly low rate of solution, suspiciously low. And when you go back and go case by case, if you put a narrative and a name to the victims, which is exactly what Mike's group is doing, you then start to see a pretty clear pattern that that these narratives are astonishingly similar. When that happens, something's going on, and quite often it's because there's a common killer in many of the cases.
And yet you start
the only problem with the algorithm is that there's a delay. It takes a year up to 2 years to get data back from the FBI. This is hardly real-time reporting. And so, by definition, by the time we're warning the public that there is a cluster that has a high probability of containing serial killings, they're already cold cases, which is exactly what we're looking at in the very large cluster of strangulations in Atlanta.
And yet you started this as a journalism major, did you not? That's where the roots of this algorithm come from? You started it as a way to report on crime.
Yeah, this was started as a project when I was a national correspondent for the former Scripps Howard News Service. It no longer exists. But this was an attempt to study unsolved murder and then to see if it was possible to identify serial killings among the unsolved murders. At that time, we did this in 2010, there were 185,000 unsolved murders in the United States committed since 1980. Today, there are over 222,000 unsolved murders, and so there are quite a few murders to cull through.
So, Mike, what, if from your experience both in teaching criminology and working as a detective, what could you have used the most? I mean, Tom is saying that there's a real lag time in between getting this data and actually putting it to use. So what else could you have used that might have brought your solve rate up or that of your department?
Well, obviously, timely access to the data is important. But quite frankly, what I would have liked to have had, and I think what every detective would like to have in their toolbox, is precisely what our site does, which is bridges those sort of interjurisdictional blind spots between agencies. So again, if you go to Atlanta, it's the statistic or the metropolitan statistical region. So you have their murder records reflecting several different police agencies that otherwise don't have a common records management system or database, or don't necessarily have a, you know, CompStat meeting where they're all at the table at the same time, or don't compare notes. And what it is for the first time ever, and this was conceived years ago in the U.S. as VICAP and in Canada as VICLASS, both of which are really failed sort of initiatives. What you have is the consolidation of years' worth of records all at one time, all in one place, that allows you to confirm hunches, that allows you to tinker with different search parameters and follow your intuition that, you know, if you see a case and it has sort of that all the indicators of a serial murder, or it's clearly a stranger on stranger attack. There are sexual elements, there are paraphilic or posing components that you can then search in real time for recent cases in neighboring jurisdictions. And there is really no way to do that so easily before now. Again, VICAP, the database,
I want to make sure we say the violent is VICAP is the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program that's part of the FBI and is a federal program. Go ahead, keep going.
Right. So VICAP, Violent Criminal Apprehension Program in the U.S. and in Canada, the Violent Crime Linkage Analysis System, which are both very similar and rely on input provided by a questionnaire completed by lead detectives in homicide cases. In the U.S., it was a voluntary initiative with very low compliance. In Canada, it's mandatory. The quality of the data is extraordinarily poor, and it might as well be not mandatory. So what we have is a vetted version of that that we have essentially built and is available not only to law enforcement but to the public, which, to go back to your question earlier on, are often the best resource the police can rely on to help solve a case.
We only have 30 seconds left. Tom, what's been your response? APD has been pretty cooperative, it sounds like. But what about, on average, is law enforcement responsive to you?
Oh, wonderfully so. We attend as many gatherings of homicide detectives as we can around the country, and they literally line up to shake our hands and thank us for what we're doing. It is breathtaking how few resources homicide detectives have. There really should be a national list of unsolved murders.
Yeah.
We're building one, but
slowly,
there is no government doing that.
That's Tom Hargrove of the Murder Accountability Project and Western University Criminology Professor Mike Artfield. That project is, you can get more information about it at gpbnews.org. Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.